We're going to look at now, again, a discussion of how the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe and the Soviet intentions and military capabilities were fundamentally exaggerated by Galen, and how this exaggeration came to affect the American strategic thinking and ultimately American political life as well. Simpson writes in Blowback, "Most important, Galen's operatives and analysts strongly reinforced U.S. intelligence's existing predilection toward paranoia about communism and the USSR, contributing significantly to the creation of a body of widely believed misinformation about Soviet behavior." Quote, "Galen had to make his money by creating a threat that we were afraid of," unquote, says Victor Marchetti, formerly the CIA's chief analyst of Soviet strategic war plans and capabilities, quote, again quoting, "so we would give him more money to tell us about it," unquote. He continues, again quoting, "In my opinion, the Galen organization provided nothing worthwhile for understanding or estimating Soviet military or political capabilities in Eastern Europe or anywhere else," unquote. And again, this is from Marchetti, formerly the CIA's chief analyst of Soviet strategic war plans and capabilities, repeating that last sentence again because it's an accurate gauge of what Galen was doing. "In my opinion, the Galen organization provided nothing worthwhile for understanding or estimating Soviet military or political capabilities in Eastern Europe or anywhere else," unquote. Employing Galen was, again quoting, "a waste of time, money, and effort," unquote. I would also note that Marchetti goes on to describe how the Galen organization was heavily penetrated by Soviet intelligence. This has been widely reported. We touched on that in Radio Free America number 3. Galen's chief of counterintelligence for many years was a former SS man named Heinz Felfa, who turned out to be in the employ of the Soviet Union. One of the things that I generally avoid in this broadcast is what might be termed spy versus spy, because the waters of double and triple agents and the penetration of intelligence services by their rivals is something that is very difficult to get to the bottom of, although it is a matter of public record that there was widespread penetration of Galen's organization by Soviet intelligence. One of the things that has never been dealt with substantively is the extent to which some of these penetrations might have actually been used as triple operations by the Galen organization. Certainly, the Galen organization had an effect on Soviet intelligence. Undoubtedly, some of the infiltrators, some of the Soviet infiltration of the Galen organization permitted the Soviets to view Galen and his activities in an accurate way. That would have contributed to the alienation on the part of the Soviets, who would have had a first-hand picture of the extent to which the United States and the other NATO countries were incorporating elements of the Third Reich and collaborating with many of the most heinous elements of Nazism. But one of the things that we will never know for sure, because it's a cinch that neither the BND nor the CIA, and in all probability neither the KGB, will ever tell us, is the extent to which some of those infiltrators might have been known to Galen, and how the Galen organization might have employed some of them as triple agents. The Soviets may have thought that they were in fact working for them, while ostensibly working for Galen, while they may in fact, some of them anyway, may very well have been working as triple agents, and the effect of those triple agents, and I'm sure it's a safe bet that there were some. How many, we'll never know, but it's a safe bet that some of them, at least, were functioning as triple agents, and may have been in an excellent position to not only, in turn, infiltrate Soviet intelligence, but to feed them disinformation as well. Continuing with how the Galen organization was able to feed the United States grossly inaccurate information concerning the Soviet Union, what we're going to look at next concerns how the Soviet forces in Eastern Europe were essentially war-weary occupation troops, and how Soviet logistical capabilities, from a military standpoint, were dependent on rail and horseback, because Soviet forces were not motorized to anywhere near the extent that Western armies were. Any large-scale offensive by the Soviet military would have been dependent on the use of rail. And as we're about to see, rather than shoring up the rail system in Germany and elsewhere in Eastern Europe, they were tearing up thousands of miles of tracks and bringing them back to the Soviet Union to help repair the enormous damage that they suffered during the course of World War II. Another major factor that is discussed in the passage we're about to read concerns the fact that as late as 1950, half of the Soviets' transport for their army was horse-drawn. Now, in Simpson notes here, in the frozen stretches of the Soviet North, that can be a tremendous advantage because Russian ponies can keep going long after motorized vehicles would have seized up with the extreme cold. But in Western Europe, that would have been a very, very different story indeed. What we're going to look at is how U.S. military analysts initially observed these tremendous weaknesses in the Soviet logistical capability and observed the fact that the vast majority of Soviet forces in Eastern Europe and Germany were war-weary occupation forces and not the highly mobilized, armored forces of aggression that Galen represented them as being. And as we shall see, the effects of the Galen Organization were to fundamentally pervert and then erase the accurate American intelligence perceptions of the Soviet Union, both their intentions and capabilities in the immediate post-World War II period. Also note that while Galen was convincing the United States that the Soviets were about to attack, the United States was the only country which had the atomic bomb. The Soviets had no navy to speak of. They had no long-range bomber force. The U.S., on the other hand, did have a very powerful air force, including long-range bombers, and they had the atomic bomb, which would have been decisive in any kind of conflict, even had that not been the case, because, as I said, of the Soviet dependence on rail and horseback, there was absolutely no way that the Soviet Union was about to attack the United States. Returning to Blowback by Christopher Simpson, the Galen Organization was the one group that did have the networks inside Eastern Europe, and that is why we hired them, unquote, international affairs expert Arthur Macy Cox says, again quoting, "But hiring Galen was the biggest mistake the U.S. ever made. Our allies said, you are putting Nazis at the senior levels of your intelligence, unquote, and they were right. It discredited the United States, unquote." According to Cox, the Galen Organization was the primary source of intelligence that claimed that, quote, the Soviets were about to attack West Germany. That was the biggest bunch of baloney then, and it is still a bunch of baloney today. Note that Cox worked both for the State Department and the CIA. Continuing. The crucial period of 1945 to 1948, when East-West relations moved from a wary peace to an intense political war, provides one case study of the damage that Galen's intelligence and analysis could produce. Among the most basic elements in the American interpretation of European events during the early Cold War years was the evaluation of the Red Army. That subject, it will be recalled, was Galen's specialty. In mid-1946, U.S. military intelligence correctly reported that the Red Army, then in control of most of Eastern Europe, was under-equipped, overextended, and war-weary. Its estimate of the number of Soviet troops in Eastern and Central Europe was quite high, some 208 divisions, but the U.S. Army concluded that these forces were almost entirely tied down with administrative, police, and reconstruction tasks in the Russian-occupied zone. Soviet military aggression against Western Europe was highly unlikely for at least a decade, if only for logistical reasons the Army determined. Particularly intriguing were 1946 U.S. Army reports concerning railroads in eastern Germany. The Red Army, it was well known, lacked the motorized strength of Western forces and relied heavily on the railroads to move troops to the front and for logistic support. The U.S. Army intelligence reports drawn from military attachés inside the Soviet zone, from the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey research teams in Eastern Europe, and from other on-the-spot reports prior to the Soviet decision to close its occupation zone to the west, made it clear that the Russians were tearing up much of the German railroad network and shipping it back to the USSR as war reparations. The Soviets uprooted about a third of the entire German railway system, including such strategic lines as the Berlin-Leipzig and Berlin-Frankfurt, seizing train yards, switches, and thousands of miles of track. Whatever else may be said of this form of Russian industrial development, it was clearly not the behavior of a military power contemplating a blitzkrieg attack. Over the next 2 years, however, the U.S. appraisal of the capabilities and intentions of the Red Army fundamentally shifted, and this change was pushed along by misleading reports and mistaken warnings from the Galen Organization. By the time the reappraisal was over, it had become an article of faith in Washington, D.C., that the war-weary Soviet occupation forces were actually fresh assault troops poised for an attack on the West. In a footnote to the passage about the tearing up the cannibalizing by the Soviets of the German railway system, Simpson goes on to add, as late as 1950, fully half of the Soviets' transport for their standing army was horse-drawn. This actually had some advantages in the trackless frozen north, where Russian ponies were useful long after tanks and trucks had frozen up or bogged down in snowdrifts. Western Europe, however, was quite a different place. Now, returning to the fundamental misinformation given the United States about the Soviets by the Galen Organization, repeating again the last sentence that I read in that context, by the time the reappraisal by Galen was over, it had become an article of faith in Washington, D.C., that the war-weary Soviet occupation forces were actually fresh assault troops poised for an attack on the West. The Americans' new estimate of the number of those troops, furthermore, was also greatly exaggerated because it did not take into account the large-scale demobilization of Soviet forces after 1945. As U.S. intelligence's primary source of information on the Soviet military during this pivotal period of the Cold War, Galen's organization played an important role in the creation of the American evaluation, or rather misevaluation, of Soviet power in Europe that has not been adequately appreciated until recently. And again, note that, as Simpson says here, repeating another sentence, the Americans' new estimate of the number of those troops, furthermore, was also greatly exaggerated because it did not take into account the large-scale demobilization of Soviet forces after 1945. To this day, and you can see this on documentaries or hear it on radio documentaries, it remains an article of faith of Cold War history that the U.S. demobilized at the end of World War II and the Soviets didn't. That is simply not the case, and that misinformation was handed to the United States by the Galen Organization. Very, very, very important piece of misinformation, one which survives to this day. So again, the Galen Organization provided us with misinformation about what Soviet capabilities were, even though they were largely dependent on horses as late as 1950 for their logistical support system, and even though they were cannibalizing the German rail system, thereby precluding the possibility of a blitzkrieg attack of the type foreseen by Galen. Because of our dependence on Galen, a fundamentally distorted picture of the Soviet Union was presented in the United States. And again, bear in mind one of the major strategic concepts that the Third Reich had learned, and we're seeing this major strategic concept being put into effect inside the United States, or upon the United States. Namely, again, the Third Reich's understanding that anti-communism, the fear of communism by the Western industrial nations, could be used as a vehicle for furthering their own interests, including the conquest of those nations, military conquest during World War II, as we've touched on, and political conquest in the post-World War II period. Now, what we're going to look at next is one of the major contexts in which the Galen misevaluation of Soviet military capabilities and intentions was put into effect. The so-called Czech crisis of 1948, in which the Soviets came to occupy Czechoslovakia, served as a major alarm bell to the United States. That alarm bell was sounded by Galen, and we're going to take a look at just how exaggerated the U.S. estimates of Soviet capabilities and intentions were as a result of Galen. And one of the things that's most important about the passages that we're about to read is to understand the role of the so-called military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower referred to it, namely not only the Pentagon per se, but also the very powerful and lucrative defense industries, because one of the major ways that the Galen Organization was able to affect American political life, as well as military life and military conceptions, was by creating an exaggerated threat of the Soviet Union, which served the interests of the defense industries as well as the Pentagon. More money was made all the way around. It also, the exaggerated views given by Galen, the exaggerated estimates, the misinformation, also served to reinforce the interests of what Arthur Macy Cox referred to as the unreconstructed Cold Warriors in both the Pentagon and in Capitol Hill. And again, I want to underscore a central point in this archive show, that, and in particular in this installment of the archive show, the effect of the Galen Organization and related elements on the United States, and I'm talking here about the paperclip rocket scientists as well as some of the other Nazi and fascist collaborators that were brought in other programs, not specifically as a result of the Galen Organization, that their effect on the United States was precisely as a result of the way in which they interacted with other major American political and military forces. The Galen Org and related elements did not operate in a vacuum, but the profound, the pivotal effect they had was precisely as a result of their interaction, both direct and indirect, with other major American political forces. One should never lose sight of that major point during the course of this installment of the program, of this archive show, I should say. Continuing now with Simpson's analysis, we're going to take a look at how Galen fundamentally misrepresented Soviet capabilities during the Czech crisis of 1948. Simpson writes, by late 1947, however, Galen had become, quote, an alarm signal, unquote, as Höhne of Der Spiegel puts it, in a series of secret conferences with General Lucius Clay, then the U.S. commander in Germany. He reported to Clay that there were no fewer than 175 Red Army divisions in Eastern Europe, that most of them were combat-ready, and that quiet changes already underway in Soviet billeting and leave policies for these troops suggested a major mobilization could be in the wind. The Soviets' behavior should be interpreted as a prelude to military aggression, he argued. Then, in February of 1948, two important events took place. The coalition government that had governed Czechoslovakia since the end of the war collapsed, in part because the United States declined fully to support Czech President Edvard Beneš, a social democrat, on the ground that he was insufficiently anti-communist. That man's name, Edvard Benes. Continuing. The Czech Communist Party took power with Red Army backing, thus strongly reinforcing Western apprehensions about the possibility of an eventual Soviet military attack on Western Europe. Within days of the Czech events, the U.S. Army General Staff Chief of Intelligence, General Stephen J. Chamberlain, Chamberlin, who had earlier been instrumental in the scientists' affair, met with General Clay in Germany. Very important sentence follows. In these encounters, Chamberlain stressed, quote, the fact that major military appropriations bills were pending before congressional committees, unquote, as Gene Edward Smith, editor of Clay's papers, has noted, and again quoting, and the need to galvanize American public opinion to support increased defense expenditures, unquote. The public in the United States was unwilling to finance the military adequately, Chamberlain argued, unless it was thoroughly alarmed about an actual military attack from the USSR. So here again, we're taking a look at how the Galen Organization, interacting with powerful American political forces and military forces, was able to have the effect that it did. Last few sentences again. Within days of the Czech events, the U.S. Army General Staff Chief of Intelligence, General Stephen J. Chamberlain, who had earlier been instrumental in the scientists' affair, met with General Clay in Germany. In these encounters, Chamberlain stressed, quote, the fact that major military appropriations bills were pending before congressional committees, unquote, as Gene Edward Smith, the editor of Clay's papers, has noted, and the need to galvanize American public opinion to support increased defense expenditures. The public in the United States was unwilling to finance the military adequately, Chamberlain argued, unless it was thoroughly alarmed about an actual military attack from the USSR. Acting in response to Chamberlain's requests, Clay issued sharply worded telegrams that strongly implied a full-scale Soviet military offensive against Western Europe was brewing, again quoting, for many months, based on logical analysis, I have felt and held that war with the Soviets was unlikely for at least 10 years, unquote, Clay cabled to Washington on March 5, 1948. Again quoting, "Within the last few weeks, however, I have felt a subtle change in the Soviet attitude, which now gives me a feeling that it may come with dramatic suddenness," unquote. Galen's studies of the Red Army provided the intelligence underpinning for Clay's comments, according to the Office of National Estimates, or ONE, according to the Office of National Estimates, ONE source, they were the, quote, facts, unquote, that supported his argument. Clay's officially top-secret telegram was quickly leaked to the U.S. press and was whipped up by the media into a full-blown war scare that is generally recognized today as one of the most important watersheds of the Cold War. I'll get the last couple of sentences again. Galen's studies of the Red Army provided the intelligence underpinning for Clay's comments. According to the Office of National Estimates, or ONE source, they were the, quote, facts, unquote, that supported his argument. Clay's officially top-secret telegram was quickly leaked to the U.S. press and was whipped up by the media into a full-blown war scare that is generally recognized today as one of the most important watersheds of the Cold War. Policymakers in Washington accepted the contention that 175 fully armed Red Army divisions stood poised in the Soviet-occupied zone, waiting restlessly to attack. Galen's central contention that the USSR had not substantially demobilized its troops since the war, while the United States had, was accepted without question at the time and widely regarded as proof of an aggressive Soviet intent toward Western Europe. And again, that myth of no Soviet demobilization survives to this day. Continuing. Equally revealing, the same troops that the 1946 U.S. Army analysis had described as being tied down with, quote, immediate occupation and security requirements, unquote, were now described in Galen's estimates and later in the intelligence summaries of the Pentagon as well as, quote, a highly mobile and armored spearhead for an offensive in Western Europe, unquote, according to a crucial Joint Chiefs of Staff war plan summary. The U.S. Army's earlier acknowledgement of the transport and logistic problems faced by the Red Army disappeared from the top-secret appraisals of Soviet capabilities. Instead, the Russians were said now to be able to launch large-scale offensives in Europe, the Middle East, and the Far East, all at the same time. And what I'm going to read now is a footnote that Simpson provides, and this is the U.S. War Contingency Plans of 1949. What's significant here is to note that not only is this estimate of Soviet capabilities ridiculous in terms of 1949, again, the Soviets had no navy to speak of, they had no long-range bomber force, and they just tested their atomic bomb in 1949. The U.S. had a powerful navy, a long-range bomber force, and had the bomb in production. But at the height of Soviet military capabilities, Even had nuclear weapons never been invented, the Soviets, at the height of their military power in, say, the 1960s or 70s or early 80s, never had anything even remotely close to the capabilities that they were being described as having in 1949. Perhaps those listeners with backgrounds in the military and or intelligence community will realize the complete ridiculousness of this following analysis. Again, this is 1949. They never had the capability to do what they were supposed to have been able to do in 1949. And again, this shows the effect of the Galen misestimates. The U.S. War Contingency Plans of 1949 are a vivid illustration of the degree of self-deception that had taken hold among U.S. intelligence analysts at the time, in part as a result of the efforts of the Galen Organization. According to a top-secret estimate declassified as a result of a Freedom of Information Act action taken by the author, U.S. military planning was based on the following, quote, conclusions as to the strategic intentions of the Soviet Union in the event of war in 1949, unquote. It is worth noting that these same conclusions were also used to justify Defense Department budget requests. The last sentence again, because it's a key. It is worth noting that these same conclusions were also used to justify Defense Department budget requests, a major Pentagon tool to justify the weapons or the appropriations for new weapons programs throughout the Cold War period was what is known as threat inflation. And again, the Galen Organization was able to have much of its effect on American political and social life because of the way that it interacted with domestic American political forces, the so-called military-industrial complex in particular. Now let's take a look at the 1949 estimate of Soviet capabilities. The following would be undertaken by the USSR simultaneously, according to the intelligence estimate. 1. A campaign against Western Europe, including Italy and Sicily, but not the Iberian Peninsula initially, to gain the Atlantic seaboard in the shortest possible time, and to control the central Mediterranean. 2. An aerial bombardment against the British Isles. 3. A campaign to seize control of the Middle East, including Greece and Turkey and the Suez Canal area. 4. A campaign against China and South Korea, and air and sea operations against Japan and the United States bases in Alaska and the Pacific, insofar as the Soviet Union can support such operations without prejudice to those in other areas. 5. Small-scale one-way air attacks against the United States and Canada, and possibly small-scale two-way air attacks against the Puget Sound area. 6. A sea and air offensive against Anglo-American sea communications. 7. Subversive activities and sabotage against Anglo-American interests in all parts of the world. 8. A campaign against Scandinavia and air attacks on Pakistan may also be undertaken concurrently with the foregoing or as necessary. 9. On successful conclusion of the campaign in Western Europe and possibly Scandinavia, a full-scale air and sea offensive would be directed against the British Isles. 10. The Soviet Union will have sufficient armed forces to undertake campaigns simultaneously in the theaters indicated and still have sufficient armed forces to form an adequate reserve. The Soviets, again, are being seen as doing all of these things simultaneously. That is absolutely ridiculous. But it should be noted that this was the accepted view at the time. Continuing with Simpson's commentary, Russia at this stage is the world's number one military power, headlined U.S. News and World Report in a feature story on the new crisis. Again, quoting, Russia's armies and air forces are in a position to pour across Europe and into Asia almost at will, unquote. The United States had fewer than a score of divisions to stand guard against this horde and seemed to be losing troops every day because of budget cutbacks and a widespread desire at home to return to normality. The Truman administration's response to this dilemma seemed obvious. Stop the cuts in the military budget, accelerate construction of the atomic weapons that appeared to offer more bang for the buck than conventional forces, and dump millions of dollars into a variety of covert operations and intelligence programs, including the newly born CIA and its chief client, the Galen Organization. It is clear in hindsight, however, that the estimates of Soviet military power that Galen provided to the Americans were simply wrong and grossly overstated both the Soviets' ability and their desire to fight. While it, quote, is still commonly believed that the Soviet Union did not demobilize its ground forces at the end of World War II, writes Matthew Evangelista in the MIT Journal International Security, again quoting, this is not the case. The overall manpower strength of the Soviet armed forces were considerably exaggerated in the West during the early post-war years, unquote. By the way, Matthew Evangelista's last name, Evangelista. I would note, too, the similarity between the way that these grossly exaggerated Galen-originated reports of Soviet military capabilities and intention, the effect they had on American political life in the 50s is very similar to the propaganda campaign that took place in the late 70s and early 80s, which led to the enormous Reagan military buildup. Again, an enormous exaggeration of Soviet capabilities, and in turn a gross underestimating of American capabilities led to the massive arms buildup under the Reagan administration. This is a pattern that we will take a look at as we take a look at the Reagan administration as the ultimate fulfillment of rollback or liberation theory. Returning again to Simpson's analysis, Galen's role in the 1948 crisis was one of the first and still one of the most important examples of blowback created by the Nazi utilization programs. His seemingly authoritative intelligence reports played a very real role in shaping U.S. perceptions of the USSR during this pivotal period. Furthermore, the reports became an important ingredient in the domestic American debate over military budgets and defense policy. In those events, General Chamberlain of Army Intelligence solicited General Clay's telegram because he knew that once leaked, it would be a potent weapon in budget battles on Capitol Hill. The idea succeeded almost too well. The arrival of Clay's warning on the heels of the collapse of the government in Czechoslovakia and related crises came perilously close to triggering a war itself. Had Galen's role been limited to the preparation of top-secret studies for the use of America's own most expert intelligence analysis, it is unlikely that his project would have done much harm during the post-war period, and it might actually have done some good. But that is not how intelligence agencies actually work. Very important passage coming up here. Repeating again that last sentence. But that is not how intelligence agencies actually work. In reality, contending factions in the government leak their versions of events to favored members of Congress or reporters and from them to the public at large. Quote, secret reports, unquote, revealed in this way, especially those that frighten or titillate us, take on a mystique of accuracy that is undeserved. These, quote, secrets, unquote, become potent symbols that rally constituencies whose concern is not with the accuracy of a given bit of intelligence, but rather with the use to which the leak can be put in the domestic political arena. That last sentence again. These, quote, secrets, unquote, become potent symbols that rally constituencies whose concern is not with the accuracy of a given bit of intelligence, but rather with the use to which the leak can be put in the domestic political arena. As time goes on, a self-reinforcing process sets in, each new leak lending credibility to the next, which in turn, quote, confirms, unquote, those stories that have already been revealed. Quoting, the agency, CIA, loved Galen because he fed us what we wanted to hear, unquote. Marchetti concludes, again quoting, we used his stuff constantly and we fed it to everybody else. The Pentagon, the White House, the newspapers, they loved it too. But it was hyped up Russian boogeyman junk and it did a lot of damage to this country. So again, the effects of the Galen Organization should never be seen as existing in a vacuum, but rather the profound effect, and in my analysis, I believe the pivotal effect that the Galen Organization effected on American and world history was by acting in conjunction with major political and social forces in the United States, and that interaction between Galen and powerful domestic political forces ultimately produced the outcome of the Cold War that took place. The Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. What's left of it is bankrupt, and we are bankrupt too. A very important element of analysis is one that will figure during the course of the rest of this archive show, and it figures in a prominent way in the analysis of the U.S. having lost the Second World War. Granted, we, quote, won, unquote, the Cold War, but we are now bankrupt. We're the world's biggest debtor nation. The SNLs are gone. The savings of the commercial banks are in bad shape. The insurance companies are in very bad shape, and they're going to be going down at some point. There's enormous corporate debt, enormous consumer debt. We're losing our industrial base. And despite the promise of a peace dividend, the fact of the matter is that because the American economy has become so dependent on defense spending, many of the elected representatives have defeated some of the weapons programs that the Pentagon itself wants to axe because basically they have a pork barrel consideration. So many of the voters that have supported them, so many of their constituents are dependent on employment of the defense industries that major weapons programs that the Pentagon wants to cut have actually been restored by members of Congress. And again, the U.S. could be thought of from an economic standpoint as to a certain extent at least being like a junkie, even though military spending per se is not particularly healthy for the economy in ways that I'll explain in a minute. At the same time, we are like a junkie. We should get the needle out of our arm. At the same time, we're dependent on that fix to keep going for the next day. One of the major dynamics that I'm going to introduce now is something which will figure in the analysis of how the U.S. lost the Second World War, and that is the dynamic of the tank versus the bulldozer. The only way that capitalism can work is for capital to be invested in such a way as to generate more capital. And capital invested in the civilian sector generates a lot more capital than capital that's invested in the military sector. Take, for example, a tank. The initial outlay for the tank comes out of taxpayers' money. It comes out of the public sector. The fuel, the ammunition, the spare parts, the paying for the crew, all of that comes out of the taxpayer's pocket. It comes out of the public sector, although there is X amount of capital that is generated for the producers of the spare parts and for the producer of the tank. Again, the funding for that comes out of the public sector, and what does the tank do? It goes on maneuvers, it burns up fuel, it shoots ammunition. None of that really generates a whole lot of capital beyond, again, the wages that come to the people that are employed in making the shells or the spare parts or whatever. All of the capital outlay for that tank, which does not generate very much capital in and of itself, comes out of the public sector, it comes out of the taxpayers' pocket, and it adds to the debt of the country. Now, the bulldozer, on the other hand, its construction cost is paid for out of the private sector. The cost of the people who operate it, the salaries of the people who operate it, are paid for by the private sector. The spare parts, the fuel, and everything else paid for by the private sector. It does not add to the national debt. It does not add to the yearly budget. And the bulldozer is involved in building office buildings, shopping centers, or factories, shopping centers, what have you. All of those things generate capital. A shopping center, an office building, a factory, those are facilities that employ people. That, in turn, generates more capital than money that is spent on a tank. Not that there isn't some capital generated by money spent on a tank, but not nearly as much as is generated on a capital spent on a bulldozer. The bulldozer produces more capital than the tank, and again, nothing is paid for. The bulldozer is not paid for out of the taxpayer's pocket. The dynamic of the tank versus the bulldozer is central to the working hypothesis that I'm developing, namely that the U.S. lost the Second World War. We have been spending our money on tanks. The Germans and Japanese have been spending their money on bulldozers. Not that they don't have strong militaries, both countries do, but they have not been spending their money on nuclear missile submarines, intercontinental ballistic missiles, these very sophisticated jet fighters, electronic warfare systems. We have. The Pentagon budgets in the Reagan-Bush years have exceeded the yearly corporate earnings of the Fortune 500 combined. And that's an awful lot of tanks and not too many bulldozers. The Soviets were completely bankrupted and ultimately disintegrated in large measure as a result of the arms race. We took a look at that in Radio Free America 36 in developing the full court press scenario. It destroyed the Soviet Union, and it has gone a long way toward doing that in the United States. What we're going to look at next in this installment of RFA 37 is another way in which the Galen Organization, as well as some of the people brought over to the United States under the auspices of Project Paperclip, namely the Nazi rocket scientists, again fundamentally distorted Soviet capabilities and intentions, and this particular distortion, namely an exaggeration of Soviet ICBM capabilities, led in a significant way to the most destructive phases of the arms race. What we're going to see now is how the Galen Organization and the Project Paperclip scientists, notably General Walter Dornberger, about whom we shall have more to say later in RFA 37, how they created the myth of the missile gap and substantially increased the seriousness of the arms race between the U.S. and USSR. In a footnote, Simpson goes on to add, Galen also played a role in the creation of the famous missile gap of the 1950s. Again, quoting, Galen provided us, the CIA, with specific reports on the Soviet ICBM program, Victor Marchetti says, again quoting, he said, we have two reliable reports confirming this, and they, the Soviets, have just installed three missiles at that site, etc., etc., claiming that he had contacts among the German scientists captured by the Russians at the end of the war. The intelligence reports were transmitted to the Pentagon through interagency channels, and word about the alarming new development eventually leaked from there into the press. Walter Dornberger, D-O-R-N-B-E-R-G-E-R, added fuel to this fire in 1955 by publishing alarming speculations that the Soviets might attack from the sea using shorter-range missiles deployed in floating canisters off the coast of the United States. He was deeply involved in the United States' own ICBM program at this point, and his opinions were given considerable weight in public discussions. The CIA soon dispatched some of the first of the revolutionary new U-2 surveillance planes on secret missions inside Soviet airspace to gather more data. Again quoting, we figured that if the Soviets had ICBMs before the U.S., that could be damn serious, unquote, Marchetti continues. Again quoting, we also figured if they had them, They'd have to move them by railroad, particularly to Siberia, where they would be most useful against the United States. So we sent out Frank Powers and the U-2s, and they plotted the whole Soviet rail network. U-2s scoured the Trans-Siberian Railroad, every spur and every missile R&D station. And nothing was found that remotely resembled the implementation of an ICBM capability at that time. It was all bull, unquote. And Simpson goes on to add, by that time, however, the missile gap story had already taken on the status of a fact, one which appeared to be backed up by authoritative leaks from the Pentagon. The issue subsequently played a major role in debates over the defense budget and in several election campaigns. And I would note that John Kennedy was elected in considerable measure on a promise to close the missile gap, unquote, and that was a myth, something Kennedy probably did not even know. Again, only a handful of insiders, such as Marchetti, a Soviet affairs specialist for the CIA, were aware that, in fact, there was no, quote, missile gap. And again, this misinformation, generated both by Galen and fueled by General Walter Dornberger, the military commander of Peenemünde Nordhausen, the Third Reich's rocket center, this particular myth, this piece of misinformation, played a major role in the escalation of the arms race. It was one of the things that led to both the U.S. and the former Soviet Union spending their money, quote, on tanks, unquote, in this case missiles, but basically spending money on government issue rather than on capital goods, which could shore up their commercial economy. It should also be noted, too, that the tremendously exaggerated view of Soviet capabilities and intentions also contributed materially to the anti-communist paranoia of the McCarthy period, and that period served as a primary sowing area, served as very fertile soil for many of the Third Reich residua that were brought into the United States under the auspices of the Galen Organization and related Nazi import programs. They began to play a profound role in American political life, and in fact they were to become the seed for a potent political force in the United States, one which ultimately became the dominant force, political force in the United States as a result of the assassination of John Kennedy. That particular force, the Liberation or Rollback Forces, reached their culmination in the Reagan years. And again, it should be noted that the generation of the Liberation or Rollback theory entails the interaction between Galen and related elements and very, very powerful political forces in the United States. Although the genesis of the rollback or liberation theory goes all the way back to Third Reich political warfare techniques, the way in which they were able to exert a dominant influence on the United States in the post-World War II period was as a result of the interaction between Galen and Galen-related elements and powerful domestic American political forces. This last passage, before a musical break, will serve as a transition to our analysis of the formation of rollback or liberation theory. Simpson writes in Blowback, one of the most important characteristics of the war criminals who did come to the United States is that they did not arrive here as isolated individuals. As has been seen in the case of the Croatian Ustashi, the Ukrainian OUN, and the Latvian Vanagis, V-A-N-A-G-I-S, to name only three, many of these immigrants were in fact part of experienced, highly organized groups with distinct political agendas that differed little from the fascist programs they had promoted in their homelands. The anti-communist paranoia of the McCarthy period gave these groups fertile soil in which to put down roots and to grow. And what we're going to look at next, after a musical break, is how these groups put down roots and how, as a direct result of CIA political action, covert political action in the United States, these groups formed the core group of the rollback or liberation theory of fighting the Cold War, which became a dominant American political force. That analysis after a musical break in the next installment of Radio Free America 37.